Welcome to our final session on policing Pittsburgh with historian Elaine Franz. Next Sunday, Jim Davison returns to present our Lenten series. His topic is On the Way to Easter with John's Gospel. And I think it will be something different. He's taking a different approach to characters in John's Gospel and their conversations with each other. And now, on to Elaine and the topic for today, The Police Have Their Say, 1919 to 1945.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I want to say first that the police are not going to have this thing. And I want to apologize for that, but I haven't seen the time to sit down to do a flashback on the history of the police and the police. I always intend to focus on the police, and I always endeavor to do that. To focusing on the police is one of the big.
Hello. Is that better? Okay, let me start again. I'll just repeat myself. I want to apologize for the, I want to thank Sarah and Ted for all the work that they've done. And I also want to thank all of you for being here. It's really, it's great. It's a wonderful, and it's been a great opportunity for me to think through this project that is in progress for me. So thank you. but I also want to apologize because the title is The Police Have Their Say, and the police have their say, and the police are not going to have their say very, very much, because it's really hard to get the voice of the police. And I've been working on it for years. This project actually started as just the voice of the police, and every single time the police want to take over. And it's because of the records, it's because of the records we have, but it's also because of something about the way we think about the police and the police. It's hard to think about the police as a single unity with a voice. Part of the work, I think, of policing in our culture is to scatter the police, you know? And so I think that may be one reason why it's so hard to actually think about representing the voice of the police. But I apologize that the police are once again going to be at the center of this frame, though I may have a little bit more of the police in there, but that's a perpetual problem with what I do. So basically, we started this series in the 1700s, very little in the 1700s, because there were very few police. We had one police officer all the way up to the beginning of the 1800s. And by the time that we're going to end today in the 1930s, 1940s, we have around 1,000 police officers in Pittsburgh, which is more, I believe, substantially more than we have today. The population was also bigger. I think the population was bigger at that point. But I want to talk about how the police have remained the same and how they've changed for just a second before I get into this period. We saw in the earlier sessions how the police moved from having to compete for a claim to authority with other potential violent state-related groups, such as military groups or other states, right? And how they had to compete with organized private groups, so vigilante groups and things like that, for their authority in the early years. We've talked about how they became a paid and salaried force of working men, you know, drawn largely from the working classes in the antebellum period, and how they attempted to establish their authority and took on many elements of modern professionalism in the 1880s. And so, but some things have remained the same throughout all of these periods. First of all, police have mainly been concerned with order violation. that most, the vast majority of what the police have done, this is going to continue, was policing the use of public space and deciding who gets to decide what public space is used for appropriately. Generally speaking, always speaking, this ends up meaning that the preferred use of public space by more powerful people is defended by the police, and the preferred use of public space by less powerful people is generally regulated by police. So policing is largely about sort of preserving public spaces for the people who have maybe political clout or the ability to have more of a say in what public spaces ought to be used for, right? They ought to be used for walking to church. They shouldn't be used for, you know, a public toilet. You know, I mean, something, you know, even something like as, you know, as stark as that, it's a decision, you know, when somebody needs a public toilet, right? Or, you know, they shouldn't be used for playing. Kids shouldn't be playing out here, you know, or they shouldn't be used for gambling. You shouldn't be, you know, being able to roll dice out here on the street, or they shouldn't be used for congregating on the street. A group of men or young boys congregating on the corner wouldn't be appropriate, because we prefer to use the streets for other things, right? You can't sell things in this part of the street because it's more appropriately used for something else, right? So the police, very largely what they're doing is policing these public spaces, and that's always been their main goal and is today, or their main actual work. Another commonality is that the police frequently have concern with morals violation. That's secondary, but that's going to become more important in this period, because this is going to be the period of prohibition. But that morals violations such as sexual misbehavior, particularly alcohol, drugs, and of course, both alcohol and drugs are going to become illegal in the teens with the Harrison Narcotics Act. Making a narcotics illegal in the teens, and then also the Volstead Act, the Prohibition Amendment, making alcohol illegal 2 years later. One of those ends up being repealed, right? And the other one doesn't. But morals violations are going to be very central to what the police does as well. The other continuity through this time is that the police very rarely get much training or oversight. Through this period, there's very limited training and there's very limited practical supervision of the police. They do begin to introduce lieutenants and captains, and they call them roundsmen, you know, to go around. But generally speaking, police always have to use a great deal of discretion, simply because there aren't rules that they could follow should they choose to. In many cases, right? And we'll talk a little bit about this at the end. But one thing I want to kind of introduce now is that the police, the work that the police has always done has always been a little different, very different, really, than the work that they are told that they're supposed to do. And it's just by necessity, the work that police actually do is different than the work that they are formally told that they're supposed to be doing. And so we'll get a little bit more to that to the end, but I think that's also a continuity. They're told that what they're supposed to be doing is enforcing particular laws, but most of what they're doing is basically stepping in situations of disorder or situations where people feel like things are out of control in a whole bunch of different ways. And so often those things have nothing to do with the law. And if you think, I can think of a few times in my life when I've been in a situation where the police were also involved. And when I think about those situations, many of them didn't involve a particular violation of a law. It would have been hard to figure out the law that applied, but it was clear that the police were the right people, or were, you could see why the police had been called in those situations, even though there wasn't a particular breach of the law. The police are often called in whenever there's kind of a sense that things have gotten out of hand, whenever people don't know how to handle something, you know, when there's a body, you know, whether it has to do with a crime or not, right? When there's something gross, when there's something scary, when there's something confusing, when there's something that feels threatening to someone, the police are called in, right? And often that doesn't necessarily map onto something where there's a specific law that's involved. Okay, and that's always been the case. Okay, so the increase in police, which is so rapid, that was largely when we get up to the around 1,000, much of this increase is going to happen in the 1920s, and it's going to happen in response to several crises of 1919. And of course, as a historian, you do these little shortcuts, but actually it does seem like 1919 is a really, really important year for the transformation of policing. And so I want to talk about all the things that came down in 1919. Ted, could you forward it? Yeah, okay. So the crises of 1919, and you can actually see a police officer back there. It's actually a downtown Pittsburgh scene. And you can see the police there sort of, making sure people get across the road or whatever he's doing, directing traffic. But basically several things happened in 1919. And there's several things that happened in 1919 or right before 1919 that I'm not going to even really talk about as related to policing, but I want you to have them in your mind. One of them is, of course, World War I had just ended. And the veterans are coming back. And that's going to have a lot of impact on policing, but I can't really talk about that yet because I haven't been able to research it enough. But you have a lot of veterans coming back, and 1918, World War I was when you actually have the discovery of shell shock, you know, the idea of PTSD. And you know, mental illness arising from military situations actually sort of is discovered, you know, in World War I. So you have a lot of veterans coming back. You have a lot of veterans coming back who are having problems, but you also have a lot of veterans coming back who are looking for their jobs back, right? And you also have, I think, one continuity is when veterans come back, they're hard to police. Veterans don't want to be policed. Because they feel like they put in their time and the police shouldn't hassle them, right? They feel very empowered, right? And this is true of both white veterans and Black veterans, right, coming back from World War I. So you're going to have a lot of returning veterans who are coming back who are sort of less likely to yield to police authority, but who maybe are more likely to be disorderly. But I can't really enumerate that for you. But in the book, we'll be talking about if I decide that's an actual issue. Another thing that happens is right around 1919 is that you have the end of the influenza epidemic. And we've all been thinking a lot about that with COVID, but you know, more people, as I think most of you know, died in the influenza epidemic of 1918 than died in World War I, right? And now we're at the end of that epidemic, but it is over by 1919. But whatever toll that took on the police were largely responsible for enforcing those quarantines. The police would be stationed at the doors of homes with infections, right? And the police would be making people wear masks and bringing people to jail if they spat on the sidewalk, right? And things like that. So the police have been very involved in policing public health at that time. And that's ending. A third thing that I think is relevant to police, but we won't be talking about today, is women have gotten the vote, right? So women get the vote right now. At the end of World War I. And I think women are responsible for instance, prohibition, right? You know, they certainly thought so at the time. But one thing that's going to happen is there's going to be a real ramping up of the police focus on moral violations. And I think it may be because, you know, women are voting. They certainly thought so at the time. And also because men were sort of adjusting to what they thought would happen when women voted, right? And everybody thought that women would all vote as a pack. You know, maybe not all of them, but they thought there would be a super big difference between how women vote and how men vote. And I think people were politically adjusting to that as well to sort of anticipate the women's moral vote. Okay, so all of those things happened. And now I want to give also a little bit of a groundwork of what the police look like at this time, because you have the Pittsburgh police that we've been talking about, but you also now have a state police, which are new as of the beginning of the 20th century. You have a state police force, which are going to become very important in Prohibition. And you also have a coal and iron police, which were introduced in the 19th century, but who basically, some people are big companies, such as the coal and iron companies, the steel companies, are allowed to hire their own police. And those police are actually deputized formally by the state. So they're kind of public-private police both, but they work for the companies. And they're really big during this period, and they're gonna be really big in strike breaking. You also have, in addition to the Pittsburgh police, places out here, I think out here during this entire period, still have, they don't have police, they have still constables. So you're still gonna have that old constable system. It's around the time, you know, when this area out here, you know, is, I guess probably by World War II, we probably have gotten police out here. I haven't really looked at out here. But, you know, for most of this period, we're gonna have constables, and they're gonna be replaced around this time by a formal, small formal police force. But all of those people are involved now in policing. You also still at this moment have more of an expectation that regular people will be available to come out as posses. So all the way up to World War II, really, you have the expectation that if there's a big crisis, like some sort of huge problem that overwhelms the police, that like normal people will step forward and be deputized, men, all right, will step forward and be deputized as deputies or special police. And that's going to be really important in Pittsburgh, also particularly in relationship to labor suppression. Okay, so that's to give you kind of the lay of the land. So here we are at 1919, and several things happen which are particularly menacing and scary. And the first one is, maybe we can, Ted, if we can move forward one. Okay, the first one is terrorism. We have a big bombing campaign, right? And those bombings are actually caused by, in some cases, by people who are very far to the left, right? And particularly the international workers of the world, who actually are challenging the legitimacy of what the police are doing, right? They're literally challenging the legitimacy of the state, right? They're saying, you know, we don't think it's fair that police, you know, are always like on the side of the companies. You know, we don't think it's fair the companies get their own police forces. We don't think these things are done correctly. You know, they have very serious critiques of the entire system. And particularly, they're very critical of how the state uses violence against particularly workers, right? And there's a bunch of ways to respond to that. But some people by this period, and this is a global phenomena, right? This part of what caused World War I, but it's happening here too. Some people are using violence to attack the system. And so we have a series of bombings in 1919. Some of us have heard about the ones in DC. You have a famous bombing, which sort of, if you're interested in Hoover, it's kind of important in Hoover's early life. We also have a bombing in Pittsburgh at the same time. There's like a series of bombings nationally, including in Pittsburgh, a judge's house in Squirrel Hill is bombed in June of 1919, June 2nd of 1919. Actually, a second home just outside of Pittsburgh is also bombed. And there's bombings basically coordinated across the country. And that's very scary. This guy was a suspect. I don't know if he's ever actually convicted, but he was an IWW labor leader, and he was suspected as being the guy who was in charge of the bombing. Now, it's tough to say, because the IWW also gets really vilified, and this sets off something called the Red Scare, where immediately they go out and they basically are like, the labor people are responsible, and they go out and like raid the labor halls, right? And they raid the IWW halls. They round up all the people in the IWW halls. But they also, generally speaking, it becomes sort of suspect to be involved in labor labor at all, right, during this period, or any sort of like left-leaning activity is considered to be potentially related to terrorism. And in Pittsburgh, there's so much left-leaning activity, right, because labor is really big. So you end up having this, this big one thing that the police is trying to do is suppress people who they really think are trying to bring down the state. And in fact, you know, there are a few people on the edges who are trying to bring down the state with things like these bombings. Just to give you a sense of how big the left is in Pittsburgh, the Socialist Party, and the Socialist Party is not the IWW, right? And they're not, you know, the vast majority of people in the Socialist Party would not be in favor of this violence. But about the Socialist Party gets about a quarter of the vote in Pittsburgh. In areas with factories, in areas where there's factory workers, in the boroughs where there's factories, the Socialist Party is getting about a quarter of the vote. The socialists have their picnics at Kennywood. You know, it's not at all like they had not been particularly a stigmatized group, but now it's like this sense that like the Reds, you know, are going to attack us. And they did in these particular cases with these bombings. Nobody was injured actually in either of the bombings in Pittsburgh. But it was scary for people. Okay. A second thing, if you want to move forward, Ted, is the Great Migration. So during World War I, a lot of Black Southerners moved to the North. And the pipeline to Pittsburgh, most of the people who migrated from the South were coming from Alabama to Pittsburgh. So most of the folks that came up to Pittsburgh were from Alabama. Many of them had been working in industry in Alabama. They weren't necessarily rural people. They're people who had been working in Alabama's steel industry. And I'm in Birmingham, but you got paid like much better in Pittsburgh working in our steel industry, and the hours were much better. You actually didn't have to work like 12 hours a day. You were working more like 10 hours a day. And so it was much better life. And so when the soldiers left Pittsburgh, cleared out these good jobs, and we still definitely needed steel, right? The folks up here actually sent down recruiters to get the Black workers from these factories to move up to Pittsburgh, right? Which they totally did. But then a lot of other people came along too. And the migration was largely men from the age of 15 to 40, right? Which are also our biggest crime demographic. So you're going to have a big migration coming up from the South to the North during 1919. The Black population of Pittsburgh pretty much doubles, right, during this period. And these migrants are going to become very much the focus of policing. They're going to be very over-policed. They're probably also going to commit more crime, right, because they're unstable, right, and they don't have the resources, and they're out in public a lot, you know, so whatever they do, they could be policed. But they also get policed a huge amount. They get policed as suspicious persons. So I just looked through a booklet of, the kind of mugshots of people who were arrested in this period in Pittsburgh. And it was just a lot of 15, 16-year-old Black youth picked up as suspicious persons, you know. So I think that there was a bunch going on, you know, but it definitely changed the nature of policing. It was seen as sort of a major threat. And then, of course, they're here in those jobs. The soldiers come back. They would like to have their jobs back, and they're going to have their jobs back, right? But in order to have their jobs back, there's going to be some tension. And these folks who were actually invited up to work are going to be kicked out of their jobs, and then they're not going to have jobs, and they're going to be picked up as vagrants, right? So there was just a big problem with sort of joblessness, right, in Pittsburgh, and that the police are often called upon to resolve. They're going to actually do things to try to take care of this. In 1919, they actually hire the first Black policewoman, whose name is Sarah McClanahan. And I just want to mention something about her, because she is a club woman. She's a prosperous, she's a wealthier Black woman. And she's the head of the Women's League, you know, or the Black Women's League up here, you know, and she said, I'm going to be the first policewoman because I want to help right? These Black women basically who are being arrested, I want to be able to like be available to them so that they're treated well and that they can be helped, right? So people are trying to deal with these things, but it's a big problem for police to deal with it. Elsewhere, not in Pittsburgh, but in many cities other than Pittsburgh during this time, there's huge race riots, very violent race riots, where even more than 100 people are killed. Pittsburgh, we actually don't have one of those huge race riots for reasons I cannot adequately explain. But yeah, there's just a lot of anxiety about this migration. You also, however, after this migration, you actually have a voice in the Black population that you start to hear much better than you have before, partially because you have more people. But by this point, you have the NAACP operating in Pittsburgh. The NAACP was founded in 1907, and they have a chapter in Pittsburgh. So when Black people are treated poorly, and particularly with police brutality, they have a voice where the NAACP will step forward and say, hey, you know, we think this happened. We don't agree with your account of this arrest or something like that. And you also have now a Black newspaper. You have the Pittsburgh Courier, which starts in 1910. And which will cover from a sort of, the Pittsburgh Courier starts in 1907 and the NAACP in 1909. But the Pittsburgh Courier will step forward and say, you know, give a sort of a Black version of what the police have done in terms of policing, whether things have been fair. Okay, as though that weren't enough in 1919, the other problem was the problem of strikes. And, you know, we talked about, and you could see how this relates to all those other things, but the problem of just normal strikes, like strikes and labor tension, is really huge during this period. And in 1919, there is a massive steel strike in Pittsburgh. From September 1919 till January of 1920, about 25,000 workers, steel workers in Pittsburgh, go on strike. And they're added by almost as many people in Homestead and Braddock. So basically you have like 50,000 strikers in Pittsburgh at this time who are demanding basically better pay. And so they're being suppressed by, these strikes are being controlled and suppressed because they're terrifying, right? Because when you think all of the fear about the other two things, right? You have all these Black workers coming up and they're kind of in the mix looking for jobs and they have some of these steel jobs. They're also working as strike breakers, right? You have the IWW in the mix and they're trying to peel off some of these labor unions when they get mad enough and say, well, if you're that mad, maybe you could join this radical, violent group, right? So they're trying to peel off people when they get sufficiently mad. And so that makes these strikes even scarier. So what happens is that, lots and lots of private citizens are mobilized to be special police in favor of the factories. And so you have special police, they bring in the coal and iron police, they bring in the state constables, and they ultimately successfully suppress this strike, but they do so with great violence. Could you move forward? And this is just an image of a Homestead image of the suppressing the strike of 1919. So there is great violence. You know, people, I don't have the numbers, but people are killed in the strike. Strikers are killed, right? So you have this problem, you have all of these problems. And then of course you have the onset of prohibition and enforcing prohibition. And this is happening at the same time that now you have to figure out how to enforce this new law, which is very, very intrusive, right? Which really sort of like gives the police permission to enter a lot of private spaces where they really haven't been before, go into, a lot of saloons and even into people's homes and, you know, things like that. And so the police gets just a lot more jobs than it had before in 1919. Now, how did people respond to all of this? One thing that happened is that people got really angry with the police about how they were doing these jobs, right? And there was a huge amount, you know, we had this question before, like, was there ever a time when the police were like more respected, right? And I was really scratching my head, you know, trying to think of when that when that time might have been. Because like during this time in the 1920s, the police are really very much vilified by a lot of people. Because of how they're handling these very difficult problems. And I'm going to give an example, which I found just for this group. I found that there was in 1924, the Pittsburgh Council of the Churches of Christ, which prominently included the Presbyterians. They actually had a Presbyterian president at this time. They did a study and they published it, which was called Crime in Pittsburgh. And they're trying to figure out how just crime and policing is, right? And it's 1923. So it's exactly 100 years ago. And so they, you know, they do this study and what do they discover? And I thought, oh, they're going to be here. We're going to find like the people who are kind of pro police, right? No, that's not what we find. Okay. So we find they totally, you know, take on the police. They say, first of all, they're totally ineffective. You know, they point out, they do the numbers, they crunch the numbers. They're like, between 1920 and 23, only 25% of murders resulted in a guilty verdict for anyone, right? So there's only like a, you know, clearance rate of like 25%. They say things like, there is perhaps no other class of men more completely lacking the confidence of the people than the constables, these kind of local constables, you know, around the area. They go group by group. They go, in Allegheny County, too many of the police are men not fit for their position. The federal prohibition agents who are coming in to supplement, they say they're corrupt. There's many unfit men, including former saloon keepers and brewery workers who have been hired, you know, for political patronage into these positions. They say, The city police are a real problem because you can't get rid of the bad ones because of civil service protections. They say that the city police protect favored lawbreakers. They're like super corrupt. And even when a certain police officer stands up and tries to punish favored lawbreakers, they get punished by the higher up police. You know, and they had examples of people who got fired basically for trying to actually do the policing, right, by the corrupt administrators. And then they also really take on police brutality, which at this point is called the third degree. They say there can be no doubt whatsoever that it has been a common practice in this city to beat up prisoners in order to secure confessions. You know, so you even have like, you know, the kind of mainstream, you know, you have the kind of the churches, you know, they're coming out. They're saying, these police are basically like no good. So the police are like faced with, I think, an impossible task, right? It was just the things the police are asked to deal with are just pretty much impossible. And like the kind of white middle class and the white upper class is basically like, you guys got to do better. You know, they're just, you know, you know, very, very critical, you know, of how the police are doing it. And particularly of you know, police corruption and police violence in how they take care of the or attempt to take care of these problems. So the other functions of the police, and can we move forward here? Okay. Oh, this is just an image of another bombing. This wasn't a radical bombing. This was a this was violence by the gangs that were mobilized in during Prohibition, right? One thing they did was bomb one of our banks, right? So the police just have a lot to deal with. Okay, if you could move forward, Ted. Okay. And then, of course, as soon as the police deal with all these problems in the 20s, and you finally have the end of Prohibition, which incidentally, the police didn't even want to police Prohibition. Like you have all these police who are saying in the newspapers, I will never arrest somebody for, you know, for alcohol. Like, you know, they're, you know, a lot of the police are basically, you know, they're Irish too, like, which is not, but like, they're basically like, I will never arrest somebody for my, so there's just all this chaos. And yet they're sort of being called upon to do this thing.
But then additionally, now you're going to have, as soon as you're done with the 20s, you jump into the Great Depression and you have sort of enormous poverty. And this is a police detective who is kind of in a hovel, you know, kind of in, and the police are sort of called upon to sort of like move hobos on, you know, like they're called upon to like get people off the streets, right? They're called upon to arrest vagrants, right? At a time when there's just a huge amount of poverty. Right. It's just like a very, very impossible task they're called upon to do. And they often do it with a combination of corruption and violence, you know, which then is not well received by the broader population, who's like, no, you need to do it better. Could you move forward, Ted? Okay. And the police, additionally, they deal with a lot of other problems, right? You know, so there's huge, whenever there's a natural disaster, you know, the police are called upon to deal with that. There's a massive flood, you know, in the middle of the Depression in 1936, the police have to deal with, I think, is that, yeah, Wood Street. Okay. If you could move forward, Ted. The police also, partially in response to their bad reputation, and you know, the other thing that's happening, if you think about the Prohibition era, you think about, this is a time when gangsters are glamorized, right? And that there's this kind of, you know, effort to kind of, you know, imagine, you know, the kind of Bonnie and Clyde sort of sexy, you know, gangster, that there really is kind of a, the police really have a really hard time making the case that they're sort of legitimate, sort of on your side, because they're being called to enforce all these really difficult situations. You could move. Oh, so they do things like, actually don't move forward quite yet. They do things like, you know, almost public relations campaigns. You know, they try to do a lot of, you know, continue to do the things actually they've always been doing, right? In addition to policing, like, you know, traffic enforcement, which is something which is a little more neutral, you know, helping the kids. The police have always helped, you know, lost children, you know, find their homes. You know, the police have always been like, you know, taking your cat out of the tree, right? So they sort of intentionally try to do more of these sort of public relations things to increase their reputation. And then the city tries to promote the fact that they're doing these things. So there's actually kind of a lot of PR campaigns around the police to try to clean out their reputation after all of these allegations of corruptions and police brutality keep circulating. Okay. So another one. Okay. So for instance, police start doing these, which we're still familiar with today, right? Going out and talking to the school children about the job they do. And like, but there's really very intentional efforts by the powers that be to sort of like create the image of the sort of kindly, you know, fatherly, you know, police officer, which really hits its stride in the 1930s as a part of response to the huge criticism of the police that's coming out in the in that same period. Okay, one more. Okay, yeah. So you can't really, this, I just happened upon this newspaper, but so basically what happens is that in the 1930s, there's this, I'm going to say, sort of schizophrenic relationship to the police, where on the one hand, they're saying, look, there's all this chaos, there's all this disorder, people keep on getting robbed, there's like an increase of property crime. We actually need more police. So here's the Squirrel Hill newspaper, and they're calling for more police. And if you look at the smaller headlines, it's all these other, you know, accounts of really bad crime. And like this woman is, you know, hit in her home, and, you know, everything is just really collapsing, right? But there's also on that same page stories of police corruption. A policeman was fired for like being drunk, or, you know, but so there's this like, there's this whole thing with like, we need more police. And at the same time, we need to fire these police because they're awful. And so, but that's like every newspaper. So people can't decide. They're like, we definitely need more police, but they definitely can't be like this, you know, and that's kind of the story of the police, you know, in the 1930s, 1920s and 30s, really. If you want to push forward another one. Okay. This was fascinating to me because I wasn't expecting it, but, oh, and you can't really see it because my face is on it. Sorry. But basically, this editorial cartoon was basically from the 1920s. And I just brought this out to show how complicated the situation was. This 1920s editorial cartoon is saying that, up at the top, it's the mayor.
And he's saying, no policemen on the wheel wagons. And the reason he's saying that is because no policemen riders on strike. And so they have scab milk wagon drivers, and the scab milk wagon drivers are police protectors, but they're not able to deliver the milk, right? And the mayor is pro union. In this case, right? And so they're saying the mayors are needing to protect, and therefore the police are needing to protect the scabs. And then down there, they're saying that if the mayor had to deliver the milk, he'd have all sorts of police protection, right? So it's really complicated here because they're actually kind of saying in this case the police are for women. And at least to kind of get this sort of job around, you know, in this system through the 1930s, but they never seem to win. They always seem to be, you know, in an end of their being decided. Okay, I'm going to move forward. Okay. And I just want to, I'm going to talk a second about technology, and then I'm going to, finish up the thinking about why I think the police are different. I'm not for police, I myself think the police are great. But I do think it's really important to understand like why this, you know, why the development is always considered a call. Okay, so 1928, there was this booklet celebrating the Black Squad, which is the police forces. You know, one thing that happened during this period was a huge technological changes of the police department. Particularly, you can go through changing from horse to car, you know, which is going to make them much faster, and they're going to start, you know, the idea that they are going to move much more quickly through the city. But it also separates them from the people as they get to cars. They're actually going to have very less connection with the community at large, and really they have less opportunity to do those other things. You know, finding lost kids, and you know, policemen when they were like walking, you know, they tried to ring his door, and actually blocked, you know, things like that. They do these kind of server things when they were walking. And then sometimes if they were on buses, they were still like, you know, acceptable to you. But then starting to get cars, and then they get in cars. They didn't work with the city, they had less connection to any particular neighborhood, and that also is going to be a PR problem for them, the policing problem. So you have sort of, in 1928, you have a celebration of police working, but it's always a celebration of police working because they're on the way out, right? You know, they're like remembering, you know, the importance of police force, right? Okay, one of the next one. Okay, here we have a person for this picture. Those are going to be here as well. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Unhearable.
Minute.
Oh, okay. You guys are good. Okay. Okay. Am I back on? Okay, so I don't know what you all missed, but I was basically just saying we're now moving from the horses to cars, which is going to be another problem of the connection of police to the community, because they're kind of cut off by the sort of the windows, and also because they're moving more quickly through the city. They're no longer going to be so much patrolmen on the beat. That's going to continue a little while into the 50s. People still believe in that. But generally speaking, we're on the track to move away from neighborhood policing, and we're moving away from the connection that police had with local communities. And so here we have some of the first police cars, earlier police cars, Dormont 1935.
And if you want to move forward again, Ted. And we're even going to then, you know, move on, you know, by the period, by the very end of the period that's covered by this lecture, we're beginning to get even police motorcycles. And you could see here, like the kind of PR of like the, you know, the cheerful cop is kind of the iconic, you know, mid-century cop. And now he's riding on a motorcycle. So we have all sorts of new technology as well, which is going to add into this chaotic mix. So I want to stop now by talking for just a second, because I know we're kind of at time, but I want to say for just a second why I think the police are always criticized. The police are very frequently criticized for several reasons. I think they always will be, probably, right? You know, you can certainly be better or worse, but the job itself is always going to inspire a lot of criticism. And the reason is, first of all, that the official job of the police, which I mentioned at the beginning, which is law and order and kind of enforcing particular stated laws, that's very little of what the police actually do, right? You know, the police are actually out there doing very different things. And the problem is they get trained and they get evaluated on like how many tickets or like how many arrests and things like that are numerical things that they then get trained for and evaluated for on the basis of. But much of what they do is helping, or but largely what they're asked to do is to, they're called to intervene when there's crises that may or may not be related to any particular law, right? It happens all the time. They're called in to do this, but they're called in when there's a lost child, right? They're called in when there's like, you know, the classic cat in the tree, right? They're called in with like two people are fighting with each other. And it's a tragic situation, right? You know, family members or there's mental illness, right? They're often called in when there's mental illness and nobody knows what to do with that about it. They're called in when somebody's really poor, right? Therefore causing a problem for other people. And yet what they're trained to do is enforce particular kinds of laws. They don't really get evaluated on or trained to do many of the things that they actually are called upon to do. Nobody wants to acknowledge their actual job, you know, which is often things we don't want to think about or we don't want to acknowledge. And we're kind of protecting ourselves from by having police who are doing these things that we don't want to think about. So I think, you know, therefore, nobody wants to step forward and no politician wants to take responsibility for regulating police. And here I'll say, police are different than the jails, but there's been a real issue in our jail oversight board that who is now retiring, Rich Fitzgerald, our outgoing county exec, famously, he would not attend the jail oversight board meetings. You know, he's required to by law, but he wouldn't attend them. He attended one and he's supposed to go every month by law. He wouldn't attend them. And I was like, why could he not attend these meetings? Is that nobody wants to take responsibility for the ugly, you know, for the really ugly things that are happening, just that will happen. Not that it's necessarily the fault of anybody, but that there are things that no politician can really take responsibility for because they're really ugly, you know, dealing with poor people, dealing with mentally ill people, you know, dealing with people in crisis, dealing with, you know, fights between family members, you know, things like that. Nobody wants to take responsibility for that. So they kind of like leave it off to the police. Also, police are seen as connected to what they police. There's a sense of contagion and stigma. If you're out there with the people doing the crime, you're probably yourself, you know, somehow connected to that stigma. It's almost like being like a funeral director or something, you know, that there's a little bit of like, oh, you're a funeral director. That's great. You know? And then finally, the job of policing always requires giving a hard time to people who are weak, right? It's what the job is for, right? You know, largely it's like giving a hard time, you know, to people who don't have very much power, right? And so therefore moral people are always sort of, you know, horrified by the job, right? So I think those are just structural things about the police and what they're supposed to do that kind of stretch through time. And that's why we find ourselves in the situation of criticism. Now, what to do about it, I honestly have no idea, which is why I'm gonna like stop my own project at 2000 one. But I would say that the best way to think about policing, I think people always want to think about like a good guy and a bad guy, and like, you know, the police are often the bad guy. But I really think it's much more a tragedy, where like the situation itself, you know, is producing sort of tragic consequences, and people are all trying to navigate it in their own way. But that's how I think about policing. So, okay, well, I should stop. But thanks.
So you're saying they're in a no-win situation.
Oh, yeah.
Have been throughout this period. And does that imply to you that almost no matter how well they would have done their job, they would have still gotten the same criticism?
I just don't think there, I think that the only way to do that job well would be not to do it, because no, I mean, because if your job is to, if what you're expected to do, okay, so like, I mean, let's take right now, you know, there's a lot of people, when I go downtown now, I notice, I feel a little less comfortable, because there's a lot of people on the streets who seem, I perceive them as menacing. As a suburban woman, you know, white woman walking through, it seems like there's more people now on the streets who seem to be in some sort of crisis, or, you know, they don't seem to be subdued, right? And so they're louder, or they're closer to me, or something like that. It makes me think like, am I safe? Am I safe? You know, and it is the job of the police to make me safe, to make me feel safe. And that really is what they're paid to do, you know, because I can complain. I have enough power to complain, right? So I think like structurally, the reason we have police is to make it safe for like me to walk down that street. But somebody else on that street, it may not be that they're doing anything wrong at all. They may just be, they don't have a good place to be inside, like their apartment's small, or they're homeless, you know, and they're just like out on the street having fun and laughing with each other. And I'm feeling menaced by that, you know? So I call in the police and I expect them to respond. And then I'm critical if they don't, you know? So I guess I really think part of the problem is that the police are asked to do things that nobody should ask anybody to do, you know? And I don't know how to solve that either, but yeah.
Well, back then, and maybe even today, I'm still struggling to see who the police report to. Is it the political head, and also, is it the union? Were they unionized back then, and did they have their own set of rules? Because I don't sense that the union is really very fond of the mayor these days, and I don't know if it's the same thing back then. So I still don't have a good sense. Did they set their own rules? Did they actually report to the mayor or whoever was the political head, or was it somewhere in between?
Yeah, it's definitely somewhere in between. The Fraternal Order of Police starts in Pittsburgh in 1915, so right before this period. It takes a while to get up and running, but it actually starts right here in Pittsburgh right before this period. The police unionize themselves. But then a lot of police are unionized, but not under the FOP. But yeah, police unionization happens. There's actually a big Boston police strike in 1919. So the police start getting their own separate form of empowerment, which quickly becomes very important, you know, certainly by the, I'm going to say the police union, it becomes really important after World War II. And once they have that, and then they're kind of also building on civil service protection, which they get earlier in the century. So it was always hard to fire police. But it was hard to fire police earlier because they had specific political connections, right? It becomes hard to fire them later because of first the civil service protection and then the unions. But it's always really difficult to control the behavior of police. And there were many times when there's a power struggle between the mayor and there's somebody, the director of public safety, you start having in the 1880s. And a director of public safety often actually competes with the mayor and often is at loggerheads with the mayor. And so it frequently happens that there's a power struggle between the mayor and the director of public safety, or even if the director of public safety is on the side of the mayor, then sometimes the men then are on the side of the director of public safety. I don't know if you remember
Chief McLay recently, you know, a few years ago, Cameron McLay, the reformist police chief we brought into Pittsburgh, had that same issue. Like, he was actually reformist police chief. Well, then he lost the men, you know, and he lost the union. So, you know, at some point, there's always some place where there's big break between what the police want, which is not to be criticized in however they do their duty, right? No matter what, whether they use violence, you know, whether they're corrupt, like whatever happens, they don't want to be criticized. And then you have the mayor who wants to have a free hand in controlling them. And it's always there. I mean, there later on, you know, we're not getting into the later period, but you actually have sit-ins where like the police sit out in the lobby of the mayor's office and won't leave. And the mayor is, you know, menaced, you know, like actually is afraid, you know, that he doesn't have the ability to leave his office physically because his police are camped out and they're protesting him, trying to keep them from brutalizing Black Pittsburghers, right? You know, and he attempted to penalize some people for, you know, police brutality, and their response was to occupy his office, right? You know, so this kind of thing happens, you know, I think that was the 80s, right? You know, this thing, you know, keeps on happening, but that definitely is the case from the time you have, you know, the union on. Yeah.
So if the job of the police is as a practical matter to keep order, and if change is constant and change is a threat to order, then I wonder if it's just that very sort of inherent conflict that leads you to say, well, then this is an impossible job, because whether this change is social change or economic change or political change, there's always change.
Yeah. No, and I think before saying, I feel now I'm like, oh, maybe I was too, it's not, I mean, there are other, so many other countries, you know, with lower rates of police violence. So it's not, I don't mean to say it's a completely impossible job. I just mean the expectations we have in the United States for how our order is going to look like, combined with our very broad economic span, right? If we had a flatter, if we all had more similar amounts of money, there'd be less perceived need for policing. And then, you know, policing would, I think, fit better, you know, in our sort of moral categories. So I'm not saying that like you couldn't possibly have better police. I definitely think you can improve the police, but I think that part of the problem with police has nothing to do with police. It has to do with our economic, you know, the fact there's so many poor people and so many rich people, and we have to kind of deal with that somehow.
Any questions online? Oh, here's John. Okay.
This is John. You know, I'm a lawyer, and I had an experience yesterday which made me think of the police, but you would have more insight into how I could solve my problem. I was at IKEA with my wife, and I went into the men's room, and there was this huge man with a small boy. And he was yelling and screaming at the boy, "Wash your hands. You know how to do this. Wash your hands." I mean, he was yelling. Now, this is child abuse, verbal child abuse. This little kid was terrified. And I can see where he's going to grow up. If he's living with this guy, he's going to have severe psychological problems. So I'm thinking, what can I do about this? First of all, I'm scared of this man myself.
Yeah.
I'm 6'4", but I think he could have just taken me out. So I thought, I wish there was a policeman here. I could say, hey, there's a guy in there who was abusing his child. And then I'm thinking, well, what would the policeman do? First of all, it's not a crime.
Right.
Child abuse is something that's really not in the criminal code, unless it's aggravated assault. So if the case went to court, it would go to juvenile court. Police don't go to juvenile court. And this policeman's going to say, well, what do you want me to do? You can go and file a child line. I could get to a phone, call a child line. If I could find a phone in there and my cell phone wasn't working. So my thought was, if there were police officers who were thinking of safety, not just crimes,
mm-hmm.
What should they do if I were to go out and let's say there were a police officer and I said, hey, there's a guy in there abusing his child. What do you think the police should do?
Yeah, I don't think the police can, because I think because just structurally, when a police officer comes up to me, even, you know, which I don't know how many times, you know, that's happened in my life, but there's no way that I would see that as a neutral, potentially helpful situation. I would just be like, what can I do to, you know, get this person away from me because I'm afraid, right? You know, not that I'm afraid of all police officers that I walk by, but in general, when a police approaches you to criticize your behavior, you're going to respond by heightening stress, right? And that's not going to be helpful.
There's another thing.
Yeah.
Let's say the police officer went beyond, above and beyond his normal duties. He got involved.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to be involved because I'm a witness.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I don't want to be involved.
No, it could be scary, right? I mean, I do think that I think that the solution is maybe that it's not the police officer that needs to take care of it. It's you, you know, and I don't mean you specifically, but I mean you, the person living on the street with the guy and his, I mean, what really needs to happen if we're going to be like idealistic about it is that people need to reach out more to their, I mean, we all have the cousin where we're like, are they treating their child well? I think what really needs to happen is that society needs to function better so that we need to call in the police less frequently to deal with things that we haven't dealt with ourselves. Right. And then also we need to like train ourselves to not be as afraid of poor people. That's really important, and to like have a broader tolerance of behavior, because I even hear from the Mount Lebanon police today, right? They complain because I was all like, you're over policing Black people. And, I made a big fuss about it. A lot of people did. And they said, look, we get a call. We never just go out and like find a Black person and decide to police them. Some homeowner calls us and they say, there's a scary person. And we have to respond to that call, right? And they call disproportionately when the person is a person of color, right? You know, so I think, you know, one thing that happens is that, you know, it has to be like a broader social change. You know, people need to stop calling police when they see a poor person or a person with mental illness or a Black person. And part of that is maybe being willing to assume more risk. Because like I am scared in those situations when I'm walking down the street and there's people I don't know and they're being kind of rowdy. Maybe they say something to me. You know, I don't know how to handle that situation, but maybe I need to tolerate more risk before I call in the police. Now that's such a tragic situation, but I don't think there's anything you could do unless you had a way to contact that man, which he wouldn't perceive as being initially aggressive. Yeah.
He's not going to be a reasonable guy.
But you do, if there's somebody on your street or there's somebody in your family, which is what it usually is, right? And you're kind of like, somebody should do something about that relationship. Then I think that's the solution, is like better. Yeah. Yeah.
This, I think, is right next to the area where they're talking now about they should be sending social workers out with the police, because you're dealing with human behavior rather than a direct violation of an ordinance.
Right. And sometimes people need help. And the police used to do more of that. Like it used to be that, like, I think I've said this before, but that people would just sleep in the police station all the time. You know, they had coffee even sometimes, you know, but that people, if you didn't have any place to sleep, you could sleep in the police station. So I think there should be, you know, more of those social services as well. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say we could probably go on talking about this for a while, because I have a number of things that I'd like to ask, but I'll just say thank you. This has been a wonderful series, and we really, really, really would like to have you come back with another one of your wonderful series.
Well, thank you. Thank you all.